Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this weekend edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Today you can hear Jill Bevilacqua's reflections for this week's gospel reading entitled There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. That's followed by a reflection on the legacy of St. Francis to the contemporary men and women religious working for justice, peace, and the safeguarding of creation. We begin today's programme then with the Gospel for this 17th Sunday in Ordinary Time, read to us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus crossed the Sea of Galilee to the shore of Tiberias. A vast crowd kept following him because they saw the signs he was performing for the sick. Jesus then went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. The Jewish feast of Passover was near. When Jesus looked up and caught sight of a vast crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He knew well what he intended to do, but he asked this to test Philip's response. Philip replied, "Not even with 200 days' wages could we buy loaves enough to give each of them a mouthful." One of Jesus' disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, remarked to him, "There's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and a couple of dried fish, but what good is that for so many?" Jesus said, "Get the people to recline." Even though the men numbered about 5,000, there was plenty of grass for them to find a place on the ground. Jesus then took the loaves of bread, gave thanks, and passed them around to those reclining there. He did the same with the dried fish, as much as they wanted. When they had had enough, he told his disciples, "Gather up the crusts that are left over, so that nothing will go to waste." At this they gathered 12 baskets, full of pieces left over by those who had been fed with the 5 barley loaves. When the people saw the sign he had performed, they began to say, "This is undoubtedly the prophet who is to come into the world." At that, Jesus realized that they would come and carry him off to make him king, so he fled back to the mountain alone.
Although all 4 evangelists recount the event known as the feeding of the 5,000, it's John's version which we heard today, and for the next few Sundays the gospel of the 4th evangelist will be read in our churches. For John follows his narrative of this event with the teaching of Jesus on the bread of life. In Mark's gospel last week we heard that the crowds were such that the apostles were not even able to have a meal. Nor was it the first time, apparently, as he writes of a previous occasion, when they could not so much as eat bread. And as he looked at his friends, Jesus would have seen that they were not only tired and hungry, but probably what we would call stressed out as well. His heart goes out to them. "Come on, let's get away from here. You need a break. We'll go somewhere quiet." And so, leaving the noise and bustle of Capernaum behind them, they go off by boat to the other side of the lake. "Jesus crossed the Sea of Galilee to the shore of Tiberias," is the rather confusing opening to today's Gospel. Easier to follow is the old Vulgate translation, which reads, "Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is that of Tiberias." John is the only one of the 4 evangelists to use the name Tiberias, possibly because the time he wrote his Gospel, around the year 100, the name had been generally adopted. In the time of our Lord, the city of Tiberias was still relatively new. It had been built by Herod Antipas between the years 18 and 22 to minister to his summer palace on the hill overlooking the Sea of Galilee, wrote H.V. Morton. He went there in the 1930s.
"I wandered in the early morning on the hill where the palace of Herod Antipas once shone in a glory of marble and gold. I looked down on the Sea of Galilee, blue under the morning sun. Sometimes I saw a white sail leaning against the wind, moving to the north, where the best fish are caught, just where the milky green Jordan flows into the lake. But more often there are no sails, only blue water, lying still in the windless heat, and a shore curving round to the north, with Magdala, Bethsaida, and Capernaum lying in the hollow of the curve. I sit there where the splendid palace of Antipas rose in shining terraces.
Tiberius does not figure in the stories of Jesus and his disciples, declares the guidebook, and H.V. Morton also writes,
there is no indication that Jesus ever visited the town, although it lay within the radius of his ministry and must have been a sight he saw every day from Capernaum and from the lake.
But our traveller found an explanation.
When they were digging the foundations of Tiberias, the remains of an ancient cemetery were discovered. This, by Mosaic law, rendered the place unclean and unfit for human habitation. No strict Jew could enter or leave the place without performing a 7 days purification. In order to secure a population, Herod was obliged to bribe slaves, beggars, and all kinds of ruffians and riffraff to take up residence there.
So much for Tiberias. The lake, however, has had many names throughout its history, as the guidebook confirms.
The Hebrew name for the lake, Sea of Chinnereth, is derived from the name of the most important town on its shores in the Canaanite-Israelite periods. The name Chinnereth resembles the Hebrew word kinnor, harp, and this gave rise to the notion that the name derived from the shape of the lake, being wide in the north and tapering towards the south.
And in the Book of Joshua we may read,
Moses had given the tribe of Gad a portion according to their clans. The Jordan was their boundary to the lower end of the Sea of Chinnereth on the eastern side of the Jordan.
In our Lord's time, it seems the most common name used for the lake was Gennesaret, the plain of which lay on its western banks. Luke uses the name, while both Mark and Matthew write of Jesus and the apostles coming to land at Gennesaret. And a scholar comments dryly, quoting John's opening words, the Sea of Galilee, that is, of Tiberias, is the Lake of Gennesaret, formed by the waters of the Jordan. And over those waters went Jesus with his apostles.
They crossed the northern corner of the lake and came to a place with hills sloping to the water a few miles beyond Bethsaida.
And in that lonely place, Jesus performed one of the most celebrated of his miracles, the significance of which, however, was lost not only on the multitude, but on the apostles themselves. As Mark was to comment later, they had not seen what the miracle of the loaves meant. Their minds were closed. Jesus had taken the apostles away to be by themselves, but the crowds had followed, because they saw the signs he was performing for the sick, writes John. He took pity on them and healed their sick, writes Matthew. And in last week's Gospel of Mark, he set himself to teach them at some length. The afternoon wears on, and the apostles, who are concerned that the crowd is showing no signs of dispersing, suggest that Jesus send them away, so they can go, as Matthew writes, to the farms and villages round about to buy themselves something to eat. Give them something to eat yourselves, is the unexpected reply. In John's account, Jesus asks Philip, where can we buy bread for these people to eat? But, we're told, he knew well what he intended to do. Writes Frank Sheed,
when St. John tells us that the first teaching on the Blessed Eucharist was so soon to follow, we see a reason why Jesus should have wanted to work this particular miracle at this precise moment.
In 1964, during the International Eucharistic Congress in Bombay, the Indian Cardinal Gracious declared,
to wish to unite all men in the partaking of spiritual bread, without at the same time providing material bread, is only a dream.
No one was more aware of this than Jesus. He knew what it was to be hungry, and although he had told the tempter that man does not live on bread alone, he was well aware of the reality of an empty stomach, a reality which is the daily experience of millions of our fellow men, writes Abbe Michel Quast.
We know that millions die of hunger in the world every year. Men know now. They know that not only a few destitute are hungry, but hundreds at their own doors. They know that not only several hundreds, but thousands are hungry on the borders of their country. They know that not only thousands, but millions are hungry throughout the world. Men have made a map of the prevalence of hunger, areas of starvation and death, appalling. The figures stand out in stark and implacable truth.
And a poet reflects somberly on the same theme.
I come among the peoples like a shadow. I sit down by each man's side. None sees me, but they look on one another and know that I am there. My silence is like the silence of the tide that buries the playground of children, like the deepening of frost in the slow night, when birds are dead in the morning. Armies trample, invade, destroy, with guns roaring from earth and air. I am more terrible than armies. I am more feared than cannon. Kings and chancellors give commands. I give no command to any. But I am listened to more than kings, and more than passionate orators. I unswear words and undo deeds. Naked things know me. I am first and last to be felt of the living. I am hunger.
Lawrence Binyon's Hunger. Although all four evangelists recount the feeding of the 5,000, John's Gospel contains details none of the others mention. The dialogue between Jesus and Philip, and between Jesus and Andrew, who specifies that the loaves were barley loaves. A scholar tells us that barley bread was the usual food of the poor. Another peculiarity in John's account of the miracle is pointed out by H.V. Morton.
In describing the fish eaten on this occasion, he uses the Greek word opsarion, which our translators render as small fish. St. John is the only evangelist to use this word, and the real meaning is not small fish, but a savoury dish, or as we might say, hors d'oeuvres. This is exactly what the small pickled fish of Galilee were in the time of Christ. This is a wonderful instance of the vivid local colour which has been detected in the fourth gospel, because no one unacquainted with the life and speech of Galilee could have employed this word.
While the meal of bread and fish on that occasion could not exactly be described as an hors d'oeuvre, our travel writer's insatiable curiosity allows us to discover something of the background of the Galilean fish trade, and perhaps of the fisherman apostle of today's gospel. One of the main trades by the Sea of Galilee was fish curing.
The large curing factory was at Tarikeia, the pickling place to the south of the lake, where fish were salted and packed for export. Barrels of these cured fish were carried all over the Mediterranean world, and enormous quantities were sent to Jerusalem every spring for the Passover crowds on pilgrimage to the temple. A Franciscan friar in Jerusalem told me a very curious legend about the Galilean fish trade. There is, in one of the back streets of Jerusalem, a dark little hovel which contains stones and arches that were once part of an early Christian church. The Franciscan tradition is that this church was erected on the site of a house which had belonged to Zebedee, the father of St. John. This family, said the Franciscan, were fish merchants of Galilee, with a branch office in Jerusalem from which they used to supply, among others, the family of Caiaphas, the high priest. Therefore, he said, this explains the otherwise mysterious reference in St. John's Gospel to the fact that he, St. John, who refers to himself anonymously as that other disciple, gained admission to the house of the high priest after the arrest of Jesus because he was known to the doorkeeper.
While admitting that this tradition is just that, a tradition, our traveller comments.
If his father had a fish shop in Jerusalem, it is not extravagant to assume that he was known as the man who sometimes delivered the fish. How otherwise, in fact, could the son of Zebedee from Galilee be known to the doorkeeper of the house of the most important man in Jerusalem?
Well, there it is, a delightful legend, and where there are no certainties, legends proliferate. The Gospel of That Other Disciple leaves us today with the reaction of the crowd to the sign Jesus had performed. And this time, he doesn't wait to gather his apostles to him, for even they had not seen what the miracle of the loaves meant. And so, he fled back to the mountain alone.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. St. Francis of Assisi is popularly known and loved as patron saint of ecology and the environment. His legendary love of the birds and animals is depicted on lofty cathedral vaults or in lowly garden statues, while his canticle of praise to God for brother sun and sister moon, as well as being one of the first Italian poems written in the vernacular, has been widely celebrated through music and song, theatre and film.
Within the Franciscan tradition, actually, this rather romantic picture of St. Francis preaching to the birds and speaking to the wolf is not that prominent.
Franciscan brother Bernd Biermann is originally from Germany, but is currently heading the Commission for Justice, Peace and Ecology at the Capuchin Friars Minor headquarters here in Rome. Since the worldwide Franciscan movement is this year marking the 800th anniversary of its foundation, I talked to Brother Bernd about the Umbrian saint's legacy to the modern environmental movement.
Still, it is very important for the Franciscan family, and it gets more and more important because more of the outward perception. When John Paul II declared St. Francis as patron saint of the ecology, he was following what was done 20 years before by an American ecologist. She was the first one to name St. Francis as the patron for ecology, but it is interesting that this came from the outside onto us, but I think it's a heritage which we do have and which we do have to cultivate even more.
Why has it taken so long? We're marking 800 years since the founding of the Franciscan Order. If this was part of the legacy, why has it lain low for so long, if you like?
Well, I think when we look at the development and we go back to 800 years ago, environment was not an issue. The impact of human beings on the environment was pretty minor, and that continued to be the case up until the Industrial Revolution. And then, of course, the immediate effects visible to the people in society as well as within the Franciscan family was more the social issues, the suppression of the workers, the bad conditions and health issues and similar things. And Franciscans have been involved with these people too over the time. And when we look at the normal societies, it's the late 50s, early 60s, where we have the first interesting and really urging publications on that. There is something happening with the environment, with what we are doing with our industry and with the way we are dealing with the environment that has negative, severe negative effects. So then it takes a while to catch up always, because we are basically part of society. So it needs also us to think through our heritage, and that's why I say we still need to work on that, but it's getting more prominent, And I do see good signs in the Franciscan family, engagement on the level of environment, together with social engagement. It normally goes together when there are initiatives by the Franciscan family.
Can you give us some examples, practical examples, of this kind of engagement that really is making a difference?
Well, there was one prominent example from Indonesia, where the Friars Minor on the island of Flores have what they call an eco-pastoral project, where they organize the local communities, which are basically small farmers, and they teach them how to do low-input or organic farming so that they can have a good livelihood. But this comes together with an organizing of the communities, and it's a pastoral work trying to make them more aware of what can be done in an ecologically sound way. That's one of the initiatives. There's more going on in the northern part of Sumatra. The Capuchins doing a similar work with local communities. That's my experience because I've been traveling to Indonesia several times up until now. But I know that there's also something going on in Madagascar and in other countries.
How much would you say then it is now a priority within the Franciscan movement?
Well, I would like to see it much more as a priority, but we will have to raise more awareness in most of our people, because often the pastoral work, the classical pastoral work, is not focusing or is not showing up the environmental issues too much. So there's a lot of work to be done on awareness raising, but it has to go along with training of concrete skills, otherwise we are losing out. It's not enough to be aware of a problem. We do need to have the possibilities to work concretely for an improvement of the situation.
And how are you doing this two-pronged approach, if you like, raising greater awareness and at the same time training? I presume you're involved in workshops and things.
Well, workshops is one important part, and of course we're trying through our websites and other parts. It's starting to raise the awareness of our people. As I'm here only since January this year, so it needs me more of a time. And also, it's a hard job for not only for myself but also for my colleagues of the conventuals and the Friars Minor, the TORs, and the Sisters Congregations, and also with the Secular Franciscan Order, because we are a small group of people. We do have to do a lot of work for that, so it's also something to combine the forces and to work together for this goal.
Is this something where the church, do you think, should be taking a leading role, not just the Franciscans, but the broader church?
Definitely, definitely. And it's not the Franciscans alone doing work in that regard. There are other religious congregations which we are also working together in engagements of various levels, awareness raising, but also here in Rome, for example, engagement. We're trying to get more involved with the FAO here to try to influence their policies on smallholder farmers and similar issues. So, yeah, the church, I think also from their point of view, it needs more of a prominence, but there are positive signs of recent expressions of the Pope. He emphasizes the role of the environment. I think this has to be strengthened even more, because it's such a pressing issue when we look at various issues like climate change, the loss of species, which we all depend on, and the desertification, which means the degradation of soil quality, which we are facing all over the world.
We have many international initiatives now. We have Earth Day in April. We have the Environment Day in June. How much do these global events, if you like, make a difference to people's awareness and to their commitment to do something about it?
Well, it depends very much on how prominent these days are actually in the media and with the people, and what people are able to associate with them. I think it's always a good possibility to have these days to commemorate and to raise awareness. Sometimes I'm a little bit aware that if there are too many of these days, it's just it's too much of information. I personally believe much more in personal relationships and in personal contacts with the people to convince them to do something different. Nevertheless, these big events are of importance to put a flashlight out for these issues.
as you're aware, many people are quite negative about the whole question of climate change, that in fact it's too little, too late, and that so much damage has been done. What is your general perspective on that?
Well, definitely looking at the international commitment, it is a very, very slow process. Looking at the climate change conference, the last one in Poznan, even in Bali, it is and was a slow process. A lot of effort has to be done. Given the economic crisis, everything has been put down in priority one, two steps even. And in that regard, I think we need a rethinking of the approach, taking environmental issues and economic issues into one approach to improve both situations at the same time. And I think it is possible. We need, perhaps, especially in the northwestern world, comprising North America and Europe, we might need to rethink our economic premises, whether an economic growth is really needed all the time, or whether we can think and actually have an economy which can be good for the people, provide everything we need without necessary growth.
The voice of the church, particularly perhaps the voice of the Franciscans in this issue, is a very convincing testimony, isn't it? How much is the voice, do you think, of the church, particularly at the local level, heard in this whole question?
Well, I think it depends on how much the voice of the church is heard at all. I think especially in developing countries, the voice of the church is very, very important, and the influence is there, and we need to do more of awareness raising and concrete actions. But also in the Western world, where church, especially my home country, also undergoes a certain crisis, I think a profound and severe engagement for the environment can give the voice of the church more of a credibility and can bring people also back to what is happening. Because I think this is such a pressing issue, finally, for a good survival of us human beings on this planet.
And my thanks there to Brother Bernd Biermann, who heads the Commission for Justice, Peace and Ecology at the Capuchin Friars Minor headquarters here in Rome. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Just look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Join us again, if you can, at the same time tomorrow for another edition of our English feature programme. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.